Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Michael, your host, and this podcast is with Kit Morton. Kit chats about flying the Jaguar in the RAF and Oman, and also being a QFI at RAF Valley. He also gives some great stories about being on 6th Squad in Oman, and also 54 with the RAF. So if you like what we do here, please head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to join the team for as little as $1 per month. Also, head over to aircrewinterview.tv to watch all of our other interviews and also sign up to our newsletter. So please enjoy. Okay, so Kip, when did you become interested in aviation?
Well, my dad was a spec aircrew squadron leader. My mum was an air traffic flight lieutenant, so I was pretty much destined to join from the word go. So,
when was your first flying experience?
Chipmunk in about 1988 as part of the CCF.
What was that like?
Hilarious. Antiquated.
So when did you join the RAF?
October 96 was when I started initial officer training, and then I hit basic flying training in about 98. So I had a year of holding on a JAG squadron, and unfortunately at Cranwell as well. I did 12 months as a ADC to the commandant there, which wasn't great for an air crew mate, but I did 6 months on 6th squadron, which was great fun, so that helped.
Did you always know you wanted to be a pilot?
No, not really. I knew I wanted to do something fun, and having grown up around the squadron, you know, my dad was on Buccaneers, I grew up in Lossiemouth and grew up around squadron barbecues and all that kind of stuff, and I guess that just influenced it, you know, good mates, fun times, and dad seemed to enjoy it, so I thought, can't be a bad life.
So you're a nerdy kid like me and always wanted to fly?
No, I kind of semi-nerdy, but no, I just sort of drifted into it and thought it. I saw dad going away on detachments and all the rest of it. He always enjoyed it, and he always used to come back with great stories, and all of his friends used to love it, so, you know, I thought, why not?
So when did your basic training start?
I started Tucanos in 98, and then pretty much went straight through 1 year on Tucano, then went to Valley, did 208 and 74 as was. Got stream JAGs, and then about I think I had about 2 months off, and then went to the OCU up in Scotland on 16. So apart from 1 year and a half hold, I actually went straight through the training system at about the right time, which was good for continuity.
So can you tell us a bit more about the flying aspect, like what the types were like to fly? Did you enjoy it?
The Tucano was horrible. It was a pig, a powerful pig, but it was a pig, just essentially because it had a propeller and you suffered from slipstream, and it was just an unpressurized cockpit, so you had barotrauma was a fairly regular occurrence. The Hawk was lovely, great jet, but plain and simple, you know, it was a point and shoot. But it was remarkable what you could do with it, in terms of, you know, plus or minus 5 seconds on a map and stopwatch. And most training, and even all the way through to the OCU, the sort of syllabus is the same. They do the basic stuff, so you do general handling, you do circuits, then you go solo, then you do a bit more general handling, then you do some instrument flying, and then you build up the complexity up until the point where right at the end you're deemed fit enough to go through. And certainly the OCU, the general handling side, is fairly minimal, and almost, I think your fourth trip is solo, and straight away you're into instrument flying because they want to get you rated so that you can go solo in bad weather, because that's the biggest problem. You don't have enough hours to get a master green or a green, so you're limited on what you can sort of land in. And then through, as soon as you've done your instrument flying, you're then into the sort of tactical side, you know, the air combat, the weapons, the tactical formation, and then all the way up to sort of 2 and 4 ship evasion, and it's a very gradual building process, but it's quick. You know, it's very quick. And if you, as I did, I had a stumble on the OCU, both in the instrument flying, because the Jag wasn't pleasant to fly an instrument. It was very speed unstable. You couldn't, like the Hawk, just set a power and leave it. It was very speed unstable, just an unpleasant experience for everyone concerned. So I stumbled there, and I also stumbled in the evasion phase as well, and very nearly came to grief. But actually, I was sat at breakfast with one of the senior instructors, and I was asking him, and I just said, look, I just don't get it, what do you do? And he just said one little sentence, and I said, what do you do about your other person when you're split in low level evasion? He goes, oh, just, you know, essentially screw them, get back on track on time and they'll appear. And that was then the penny dropped, and after that it was fine. You know, I did a chop ride, I think, with now a very experienced Typhoon QY, who'd never flown with me before, and he said, yeah, you're fine, no problems at all. So yeah, it's difficult, there's absolutely no doubt about it. It's not an easy route to the cockpit. So but then when you hit the squadron, it starts all over again.
Yeah. So how many hours did you have on basic trainers before you went onto the Hawk?
About 120 Bulldog, 120-ish Takano.
Was that standard, or is that?
Yeah, it's about normal. Yeah, about normal, because I went through the UAS system. So you could do less, you could do a little bit more, but that was about right.
Kip chats about the Jaguar and 54 Squadron. So what was your initial thoughts of the Jag?
Having gone from the Hawk, it was just an ergonomic slum. There were a mass of switches, and because the Hawk was nothing, the Hawk had nothing on it other than the head down information, which was simple, you couldn't really screw it up. Whereas this thing had all kinds of nonsense buttons and rotary switches that changed the function of things, and that didn't really sink in until probably into your first tour, about how complex it actually was. And once you knew what functions you used the most, you left the rest alone. But it was actually quite easy to get yourself in a bit of a mix with things like the nav system, and you could quite easily screw your life up quite badly.
You don't want that, do you?
No.
So can you tell us about the training on the Jag? How did it start and what did it entail?
Well, again, it's a very building block approach, but they expect you to be able to fly, obviously, because you've gone through TAC weapons. So, you know, they expect a certain level of professionalism. But the biggest stumbling block is getting to use the kit. And one of the early hurdles is instrument flying. So you kind of go through the general handling, then you do your first solo, they build a little bit on that, but very quickly they're into instrument flying, and that's when the kit becomes a bit of a nightmare, because you're just not used to handling it. And once you do the instrument flying, you're then able to go off and do low level navigation, you then start the sort of weapons phases where the QYs take over, and you then go and do strafe bombing. So you do all the different types of bombing, from loft, toss, you do strafe, level, shallow dive, high dive as well. Really just academic stuff, most at Tain Range, because we did half of our OCU at Scotland, up at Lossie. And once you've mastered that, you then go on to the sort of the simulated attack phase, where you're low level as a singleton first, then as a pair. So you're not only bringing in the weapons, but you're also bringing in the formation. And it's, again, they just build on the stuff that you've learned and that you know, and that they just feed it in, drip, drip, drip. And sooner or later, you either pass and you learn, or you hit a brick wall, and that's when guys struggle, and that's when you get chopped.
Yeah. So what was it like coming from the Hawk? Did the Hawk train you well for this?
In terms of speed, yes, and the nav and the formation, but in terms of kit management, not at all. Certainly I found the biggest hurdle was going from essentially a very simple jet, which is, you know, you've got one engine, that's about it, to a kind of all singing, all dancing electric jet with some quite interesting handling characteristics as well, and there's a lot more to think about. So that I found that the hardest part.
Could you tell us what your first trip was like in the Jaguar?
The first trip on the OCU was just a blur, because you know you've done it all in the simulator, but then you sit in the cockpit for the first time and your brain turns to mush and 50% of your capacity is left on the pan. But actually my first trip in the Jag prior to that was as a holding officer when I was backseat of a bounce, which was hilarious fun. So I think we were bouncing a pair or a four ship up in Scotland, and I came back down with a massive grin on my face going, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is definitely what I want to do. So I joined 54, straight out of the OCU. I left the OCU on the Friday in 2000 and then joined 54 on the Monday. And I was a fresh-faced junior pilot. That's when the training really started, because although you're qualified, you're not what they call combat ready. So you then do a workup. So you do a bit more of the sort of electronic warfare stuff, and essentially they take you through the whole course again, just to make sure you're up to squadron standard. 54's sort of dedicated role was tiled, so laser designation, LGBs, which was fascinating from a sort of tactical point of view, with that certainly with the Paveway 2s and 3s that were coming in at the time. So yeah, as a junior pilot there was always stuff to do, always things to read. You were literally bottom of the pile. I think I was OIC fish tank while I was there until I got my pairs lead. So yeah, you were you're bottom of the pile, but I had some great mentors. I won't mention them to save the embarrassment, but I had some brilliant mentors, and they were just a fantastic family, really. And I loved it. 2.5 years, and it did wonders for my flying, being with such a capable bunch of people. And certainly when I went back to Valley, having been instructed by guys of that caliber made me more sympathetic towards the student, I think, when I went back as an instructor.
So was 54 Squadron just air to ground?
Predominantly, yeah. All of the Jags were generally air to ground. We did a little bit of air combat, but that was mostly a handling exercise. And if you ever found yourself in a turning and burning fight with anything, you were probably not going to survive, or you were going to hit the deck at sort of 0.6 and run away very quickly. So yeah, I think 6 were the night squadron, and obviously 41 were recce. But we all did a little bit of the other roles as well, but 54 was predominantly the tiled and LGB squadron, which, you know, I quite enjoyed, because I wasn't a recce puke and I didn't really like flying at night, so you know, that suited me down to the ground.
So how many jets did they have on the squadron?
Colt used to run a wing jet system, so you didn't have your own dedicated squadron jets. It was all depending on, and especially when the OCU moved down, they would have times where they desperately need the T-birds, so your squadron, if you had a T-bird on your squadron, it may go to the OCU for a couple of weeks. But normally you'd have 8 jets-ish on the line at any one time, and there were about 12 pilots, so there was normally plenty to go around.
So how many times a week did you fly?
Well, in an average month you could expect to get 25-30 hours of flying, so once a day was about right.
So could you walk us through a typical day?
A typical day was very much, you know, like a typical day at Valley in many respects. You'd be in for your 8 or 8.30 Met brief, or if you had an early push, you'd be a 7 a.m. Met. And then it was straight into the planning cycle, depending on what you were doing. Obviously, for air combat, there was very little planning. You just did the mandatory safety briefs and then got airborne to your area. But if you're doing an attack profile or you're doing a fill with the F3s or F15s, then there was obviously that liaison to be had. And each one of you had your own role. So if you're doing four ship, you know, number one, he generally picked the route and decided the tactics. Two would plan the route physically, three would do the targets, and four would be the T-boy, and he'd just, you know, pick up the odds and sods and do the photocopying, things like that. And you'd be on a 4 to 5 hour planning cycle. And then when you come back down, you might fly again, but bear in mind that everybody had their own secondary duties to do. So there was always stuff to be done, both for the squadron and outside the squadron. So days were full. You were never left sitting around doing nothing, let's put it that way.
No. Well, I'm going to be a bit of a nerd here because I heard you said you went up against F-15s and F-3s. How did you come out on that?
Not too badly most of the time. Every once in a while you used to get shot. Certainly if you had no fighter sweep, you were in trouble because you were essentially, you know, it was like a game of British Bulldog, but you didn't have a stick to throw back. But if you could sucker them down, if the weather was poor, and depending on their rules of engagement, if they had free fire and they could just shoot anything, then you were pretty screwed. But certainly if they had to do a VID or anything like that, and you could get them down into low level, you know, they used to get their skirt in a bit of a twist and they didn't like it. So you could actually run away, and it seems that as soon as you get the F3s down sort of below 2,000 feet, all their SA goes out the window because they haven't got this god's eye view. They're running around on a billiard table with sort of mountains and stuff. That was where you used to be able to sort of run away bravely, as it were. And if you're really lucky, maybe shoot one. But that very rarely happened.
So how many squadrons were based at Coldershaw, and did you interact with each other?
We had three. We had obviously 6, 54 and 41, but then also you had the OCU as well. We didn't really get involved with the OCU very much for obvious reasons, but certainly if we wanted a big push, you know, we wanted an 8-ball or something like that, then yeah, you could get 41 or one of the other squadrons involved. And if one of the squadrons was on ops, so they were over in Turkey, then sometimes the guys would come over and they'd just fill in for us, you know, and because otherwise you end up with a squadron that's half manned, and essentially they end up not doing that much. So we'd take them over, and you know, they'd be part of a big mish, and it was good because you mingled, you learned by osmosis what other squadrons were doing rather than being very much siloed. So plus culture was different because you weren't on HAZ sites or anything, so you were all together, you all used to drink in the same bar, and it was very much a one big family really at Colt. It was a bit like Shangri-La out there in the corner of Norfolk, so I loved it.
Kip chats about being a QFI. So you went back to Valley as a QFI. Could you tell us about that?
It was a bit of a stinger, really. I didn't want to go back to Valley, but essentially needs must when the devil drives, and the devil said they needed QFIs. So I was quite fortunate. I went back with a good mate of mine from the UAS, and we ended up on 74, which was the sort of tactics squadron. So you do all the air combat and the SAPs, and so the slightly more fun squadron. And again, it was the same process of conversion back to the Hawks. You did a bit of ground school, you do some sims, you convert back onto the Hawk, do some nav, do another rating, and then you're back over, and then you're in the delightful hands of CFS, and they then convert you to what are the new setups, because obviously all of the air combat setups, all of the evasion, and they have there are lots of gates that you've got to go through in terms of what the student has to see, what the student has to do, and it's actually quite difficult to get it all into one 50-minute sortie, certainly for things like 2v1 and evasion and SAPs and so on. So you kind of have to learn the mouth music, learn also when not to talk, which is what a lot of QFIs suffer from, is that they just keep talking and there's no point because the guy in the front is not listening to you. You know, he's lost SA and you just need to be able to reset him. And actually a couple of words here or there is much better than just blaring on from the back about how great you are and how your demo is perfect. So there was a lot of that, and that took some getting used to. But you go through all of it. You go through the air combat, you go through some of the academic weapons, but generally we don't teach that because we're not Q-wise. And then you go through CFS, and then they do what's known as blogsing. So a CFS guy, very experienced CFS guy, will sit in the front. He will blogs, being a student, and then you have to fault analyze and debrief. And then when you've gone through the whole syllabus and done enough of those sort of ticks, then you're allowed off with your first student. And you're probationary for about 6 months, and then you do an upgrade. Up to a B1, and then you can be a B1 for as long as you want, or you can go up to an A2. I actually did my A2 QFI when I was on the JAG, because there was no point doing it at Valley, since they already knew I was going to be leaving. So they didn't want to put time and effort into me, since I was going to be leaving. There wouldn't be any return for Valley, so, which was fair enough.
I've heard the term hood cripple before, going back to the Hawk. Was that the case with you?
It was a little bit weird not seeing the green writing, but actually there's because it's the Hawk is so easy to fly, you don't need the HUD. You know, you set a power and it will sit at 420 knots. You know, there's no need for a HUD in many ways. It's nice to have the green writing, certainly, but actually you don't really need it. And it certainly with students, a HUD is a face magnet. You know, they all they're doing is looking at the green writing, whereas actually you want them looking out. Certainly we saw that, and I saw that in the JAG when I went to Oman. You know, you fail the HUD on the guy and suddenly they don't know what's going on, and they go, oh yeah, there is an entire world outside the HUD. So yeah, green writing is great, but it didn't take me that long to get back into it.
So I've always wanted to know, do you get stuck with like the same students, or is it...
No. You for precisely the reason that you need everybody, because everybody comes from different backgrounds. Obviously you've got the Harrier mates, JAGs, Tornadoes, F3s. We had Kafir drivers from South Africa. We had Mirage 2000 guys. Everybody gets to see a different way of flying, and you absorb by osmosis from all of the different types. Obviously you wouldn't want to learn low level bombing from an F3 mate, but you know, it's when it comes to air defense, yes, they know more than the mud movers, so it's good to get a broad church, and it's good to learn from everyone.
So can you see straight away that's if someone's going to be a great pilot or not so great?
You can normally see those guys who are gifted, the naturals. But that said, I know some naturals who have failed at the last hurdle. You know, they get to an OCU and they suddenly hit a brick wall. And then I've seen other guys who, they were Joe Average, Mr. Greyman, and then they hit TAC weapons and they suddenly spring into life. You know, there are the odd few gifted guys. You can see, yeah, he's going to be a test pilot, or he's, you know, he's going to work for NASA in the long run. But you can't really tell. You can tell the ones that are never going to make it, because generally they get weeded out fairly early, and that's normally a capacity thing. You know, when you suddenly go from 240 to 420 knots, that's a big step up. And if you're not 2 minutes ahead of the jet, you're going to start to suffer.
Can you see where students may get streamed if you say Tornado F3 or GR1? Can you see that?
We at the end of this course, on the TAC weapons course, actually all of the guys at what was 74 or now or 19, they would all get together and they would look through the reports, and essentially it'd be a CAG, so it'd be a character assassination group. And there'd be one instructor who had, I don't know, five or six students under his sort of purview in terms of a course commander. And he would stand up and he'd say, right, this is Blogs. They go through all of your scores and they look at where you failed, so if you had any bad trips, and then they'd look at that individual, and then they'd find the instructor that sort of took that and said, what did you think? Was it just a minor blip? And actually it was fairly intense. And you would make recommendations as to where you think they'd go. And obviously you take their preference into account. But if the guy says, you know, I want to go F3s, but he wasn't a very good air defender, but he was a sensational mud mover, then, you know, you'd go, okay, well, he's not really fit for F3 or not really fit for air defence, but let's send him one of the other three ground attack roles. And it'd be a long meeting. It'd be a good couple of hours, and you would dissect each student to the nth degree, because after all, you're not just talking about where they want to go and what they want to do. You're talking about the safety of other crews and all the rest of it. So it was taken very seriously.
So how long did you spend at Valley then?
Total, probably, well, nearly 4 years as a student and instructor. That was long enough.
Yeah. Kip chats about flying the Jaguar in Oman. So you then went on to fly the Jaguars in Oman. How did this happen?
A friend of mine was coming to the end of his tour in Oman, and for me it was a way out of Valley. The Jag was potentially not going to last in the UK for a full tour, so I could see myself getting stung with going back to another OCU to maybe go and do the Tornado or something, or God forbid the Harrier, because Typhoon wasn't in yet, and I would have been trapped in between several types. So I did the right upgrades, started making the right noises, and approached the desk officer and said, you know, this is what I want to do, what do I need to do? And I made myself the man for the job. Nobody else wanted to do it. So yeah, shortly after, I sort of said I wanted to do it, and I managed to get all the ticks in the boxes. They said, yeah, you can go. So I think there was about 3 or 4 months in between my predecessor leaving and me arriving, so it worked out pretty well.
So did you have to retrain on the Jaguar then?
Yes, I went back through what was then 41 Jag training flight, because the OCU had, I think the OCU had folded by that time. So they had a JAG training flight who would do all the refreshers for, because they weren't taking any more students, it was just guys who had already qualified who were coming back to the JAG to live out its last few days. So yeah, I went back onto the JTF and I did a quick refresher, it must have been 20, 30 hours, maybe something like that, and then straight out to Oman. So it was a arrive with a bump, as it were. Just a quick refresher, and then because I wasn't going to be providing any service to the RAF, as it were, in the UK, so they didn't want to spend a load of hours on me, so get me back in the cockpit, competent, capable, and then off you go. That was pretty much it.
Did you find it a struggle, or was it riding a bike?
Riding a bike. It was a bit strange, because it's a big old beast compared to the Hawk, and it doesn't turn, and but actually going to a simpler jet and then coming back again meant that I got to grips with the kit a lot better. And going through ground school, because I went through ground school again before going back to the JTF, and actually a lot more sunk in second time round. So it did me a lot of good, actually going back and then coming back out again. So yeah, it was good.
Must have been nice having reheat again.
Yeah, it's always nice having reheat.
So what were your roles out in Oman?
I was a squadron QFI, but I was also frontline as well. So I got the best of both worlds in many ways, but normally I would be predominantly student flying. But I also did my four-ship upgrade. I did MVG, did the tiled. I also did bounce qual as well. I was the sort of flight test pilot as well, so any aircraft that came out of a major service, I'd then go and do the full flight test regime as well, which was It could be a bit sporty, because if they'd been a hanger queen for a few months and then you went and took them flying, you had to kind of know your systems and know your stuff in order to be able to come back and fully debrief the guys and get the jet fully sorted before it hit the line again. So a bit of everything, day, night, dawn, NVG, taught all the air combat, I did OLF. The rules were slightly laxer, I think is probably a word. OLF was 50 foot, normal low flying was 150, air combat, normal base height for someone like me was 150 feet, AGL, whereas in the UK it's about 5,000, I think. So you were full up air combat at ground level essentially, and if you then had an OLF, so if both of you were OLF qualified, you could do OLF and you could do air combat sort of at the same time. So if you could merge at 50 feet and then your base height suddenly tripped up to 150. So it was fighting really right at the edge of what the Jag was capable of, and that taught me a lot about the handling of the aircraft. So
can you remember your first trip on Oman?
Yeah, we went to Kassab. We were they were on detachment at Seeb in Muscat, and one of the guys, the other Brit QFI there, said, "Oh well, I'm flying to Kassab. Let's go to Kassab." Now, Kassab is about 10 miles from Iran. It's on the Musandam Peninsula. The approach for sort of the 0502 runway-ish, I can't remember which one, is down a wadi with a couple of 90-degree turns. And finals turn, you probably get within a couple of hundred feet of what looked like a solid granite hill. And you just come around the corner and then there is the runway just appears in front of you. And that was my first sort of, that was my arrival with a bump, quite literally with a bump. Yeah.
So how did it differ compared to UK flying?
Longer takeoff run, obviously much, much hotter. During the summer it would be quite happily 40 degrees, but then over the runway with the tarmac and the concrete it would be 50 plus. So thumb rate was 11,000 feet and we regularly use 9,500 feet of it. So it was speeds commensurately higher with that. It was hot, heavy, high. So you're kind of operating really at the limits of what the Jag was able to do. Hence, you had to treat it with respect.
What models were they?
Essentially the same. The only one that differed slightly was they had the trainer, what they called the B version, with air-to-air refueling. So the pitot probe was changed for an air-to-air refueling probe. And you could actually go and air-to-air refuel in the T-Bird, which was hilarious fun because you literally just drive straight at it. Normally with air-to-air refueling with the Jag, because it's the refueling probes on the side, you're looking at references in the head-up display. Not with the B version. You just literally drive that big old thing straight into the basket and off you go.
It's a bit easier?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit easier. It was a bit weird, but it was a bit easier, yeah.
So what was it like getting used to the heat?
Yeah, that was the big one. The biggest thing was the takeoff roll. It was, you know, you'd be still trundling down the runway and you're passing sort of 7,000-8,000 feet, and that's the end of the Coltishall runway essentially, and you're still not off the ground. So it was the performance you suffered. But once you're up at, you know, 450, it was fine. You didn't really notice it. It was a rush to get airborne so that you could turn the air conditioning on, because you used to turn the air conditioning off to get airborne because it would bleed about 5% of the power from.
Oh, yeah, taxi with a canopy open.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's like a greenhouse in there.
Yeah.
It's dreadful. So, and sometimes if you had to wait for too long, you used to get the engineers to come out and open the avionics bays because it was just too hot, and then you'd fry the avionics. So, always taxi with the windows open.
So did they always have to be in hangars when they were on the ground?
Yeah, normally, or they were in sunshades. I actually got in a jet for a flight test, and it had been outside for, I guess, an hour. the metal. I pretty much almost burnt myself on the metal from the buckles, because they'd been left stuck inside of the, you can just see it up there, they used to stick the metal buckles just in the head box, and the sun had been on it, and it was so hot, I ended up with a kind of red burn mark on my hand. It was, and the nav kit was just, you know, was just raging hot because it's all painted black. So it doesn't do the jets any good, and the IN tends to fall over if you get it too hot. So yeah, sunshades were a must, pretty much.
So how did they utilise the Jaguar over there? Was it air to ground as well?
Pretty much, yeah. All air to ground, although they did hold QRA, which they had a couple of nine lemurs, and they used to operate slightly differently in that every aircraft had flares, so you always got airborne with flares, always got airborne with at least 60 rounds of HE in the gun. If you're lucky, you had two by 120. So they were very big on, you know, coming back through axial range and doing a strafe FRA or something like that. So it's very much a, you know, use it. And axial was pretty much our own range. Nobody else really used it. So you could just bowl in, do a strafe FRA, stay for a couple of runs at the end of a sortie and then home. But essentially exactly the same, only they would use us for QRA, for intercepting aircraft, which daylight only. But yeah, that was the only real role difference.
So can you tell us what squadron you were with over there?
Yeah, I was on 8. So there were two squadrons. There was 8 and 20. 8 was the OCU, but we also did some frontline stuff as well. So yeah, we normally had 3, maybe 5 students at a time. So one course was just finishing and then another was just starting. So we had a continual sort of turnover of students who come from the Hawk, or some of them had been to Jordan and done the F5. But yeah, we had normally three gusting 5 students at any one time.
So how many jets and aircrew did you have on the squadron?
Jets wise, I'm just trying to think. Normally any one day we had about 6, so not as many as the UK, maybe slightly more, maybe 7. And we used to pretty much pool 8 and 20 squadron resources, so that, you know, I could go and fly as a 4-ship lead with guys from 20, or I could just fill in, or I could be the bounce, or somebody else could be the bounce, and blah blah blah. So although they were two separate squadrons, pretty much we acted as one entity. So there was always flying to be had.
So how did they operate?
Pretty much along the lines of the UK. A lot of the SOPs were the same. They used to come back to Coldshall for their sim runs, so obviously a lot of their all their procedures were very, very similar. So there are some slight differences as to how they used to run certainly their 2v1 and their intercepts, which you didn't really used to do in the UK, but the GCI and things were slightly different, but other than, in terms of the ground attack role, almost exactly the same.
So did you ever train with any other nations over there?
They used to have exercises. There was Magic Carpet used to come over, and so the Brits would come over, and I think the Americans were there as well. I'm not sure if the French ever turned up, but certainly, yeah, NATO countries used to pitch in, and it was seen as being, certainly for those guys who were on their way to Afghanistan or doing any of that sort of desert operation, it was good exposure for them. And actually it was good exposure for our guys as well, because we were kind of out on a limb. When we got the F-16s, that was a real bonus, because then we started doing a lot more of fill. You know, so the guys became much more aware of radar threats and AMRAAMs and all this kind of stuff. So that certainly improved their skills in terms of what they could do, and their awareness, because up until that point, certainly, you know, in the old days with the JP Strike Masters and the Hunters, it was just rush around and blow stuff up, and there wasn't a threat out there. So once we got the F-16, the guys started to become more RWR aware and threat aware, so that was good. And certainly working with the NATO nations, tankers as well was a real bonus. because the guys very rarely got to tank. They didn't have their own domestic tanking facility, so that was a great opportunity to get airborne and train the guys in air-to-air refueling both day and night. So it was great for the guys to see the other guys coming over.
Did you ever get a trip in an F-16?
I never did.
That you wish you did.
Disappointingly, yes.
Do you have any memorable trips out there?
Yeah. When CFS came over, when I did my A2 upgrade, we did a night four-ship low-level evasion, which is something you would never do in the UK. So you'd do night a fill, where you'd have a radar threat, but night evasion with a visual bounce. So you're 150 feet, four-ship card, and there's a visual bounce out there as well. And including that, some air-to-air refueling, that was probably the pinnacle, and actually very difficult. Very, very difficult, hard work, and you had to be on your A game, really. So that was definitely the best, one of the best sorties that I ever took part in, UK or Oman, definitely.
So how long did you spend out there?
Nearly 3 years. Yeah, I think I was originally contracted to go out there for 2 years, 3 months. I think that's a standard sort of loan service period. But I extended because I was coming to the end of my service, and I extended by 9 months to take me right up to the end. And then I went travelling for 3 months around the world. So it was good. It was a good end to my career. I think I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, we've all seen them videos on YouTube of the beat-ups. Have you ever done that?
Only once, and it's on the video that I think has been posted on your website. So yes, final beat-up. But I never did any of the sort of 6 foot across the pan. That was the hunters. I think a wise sage once said that you never win the low-flying contest. And that's very true, you know. There's always someone who's done it lower and faster, and to be honest, I'd rather be able to land afterwards and not embarrass myself.
Yeah. So did you have to get permission to do that?
Yes. Well, yes. Yes, you do. Well, it was my last trip, so I was going to do it anyway. What were they going to do? Stop me flying.
So overall, did you enjoy working with the squadron?
I did, yes. Yeah, there were some cultural differences which took time to sort of learn how to walk amongst, but ultimately I had a fantastic time in Oman, and I left on a real high. It was a brilliant time. The flying was fantastic. They were great guys, and I had a phenomenal time, and I couldn't have hoped to sort of finish on a better tour, I don't think.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews, and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.